Chapter 6 Infiltration. Kalis pointed. Eric nodded, then signalled for his squad to move out behind him. The men duck-walked in the gully, keeping their heads below the rim of the wash through which they were approaching their opposition. Eric was both sick to death of this drilling and frantic that it might not be enough. In the 6 months since he had taken the first band of soldiers into the mountains, he had judged he had a solid 1,200 soldiers under his command, reliable men who would survive on their own for as long as possible. There were another 600 men who were close, needing a bit more training. The band he led now were those he feared would never become the soldiers needed to win this coming war. Alfred tapped him on the shoulder, and Eric turned. The corporal pointed to a man on the other side of the gully, who was not walking as instructed, letting the discomfort in his knees drive him to recklessness. Eric nodded, and Alfred nearly dove to get to the man and pull him to the floor of the gully. Sharp rocks cut both men, but Alfred's hand clamped hard over the soldier's mouth, preventing his cry from being heard by the nearby sentries. Eric could hear his corporal's whisper, "Nah, Davy, your sore knees just got you and your comrades killed." A distant voice told Eric the exercise was a failure, and as if reading Eric's mind, Kalis stood and said, "This is done." Eric and the others rose, and Alfred jerked the soldier named Davy to his feet with one powerful tug. Now his voice was unleashed in all its volume and fury.
"You rock-headed layabout! You sorry excuse for a water boy! You'll regret the day your father looked at your mother when I'm done with you!"
Kalis heard a challenge, turned, and called out the password. He motioned to Eric, and the sergeant major and his captain walked away from the men. Kalis said, "Corporal, start them back to camp." Alfred shouted,
"You heard the captain, back to camp! Quick, march!"
The soldiers set out at a ragged run, and the corporal harried them every step of the way. Kalis watched in silence until the men were out of sight, then he said, "We have a problem." Eric nodded. The sun was setting in the west, and he said,
"Each day about this time, I feel as if we've lost another step. We're never going to get 6,000 men trained in time."
"I know," said Kalis. Eric looked at his captain and sought any hint of his mood. In the years he had spent with Kalis, he had come no closer to being able to read him than he had the first day they had met. He was an enigma to Eric, as unreadable as one of those foreign texts William kept in his library. Kalis smiled.
"That's not the problem. Don't worry. We'll have our 6,000 men in the field when the time comes. They won't be as well trained as either of us would like, but the corps will be solid, and that backbone of really fine soldiers will help keep the others alive."
He studied his young sergeant major's face for a while, then said,
"You forget that the one thing you can't teach is the seasoning you get in combat. Some of the men you judge fit will get themselves killed in the first few minutes, while some, you would wager everything you have, will perish, will survive, even flourish in the midst of the carnage."
His smile vanished.
"No, the problem I speak of is we've been infiltrated."
Eric said, "Infiltrated? A spy?"
"Several, I suspect. It's a hunch, nothing more. Those we face are occasionally heavy-handed, but they're never stupid."
Eric thought it time to broach his own unease.
"Is that why the Prince's guards are ensuring no one sees the Royal Engineers building supply roads along the rear of Nightmare Ridge?"
"Nightmare Ridge?" asked Kalis. His expression was clear to Eric. He wasn't being disingenuous. He didn't recognize the name.
"That's what we call it in Ravensburg," answered Eric. "It's probably called something else up north."
He glanced around.
"I ran a company up into the north, and took 'em farther than usual. We ran into a company of Pathfinders and a bunch of Prince Patrick's household guards.
I could hear the sound of tools coming from the other side of the valley we entered, echoing from behind the ridge. Trees being felled, anvils striking steel, and spikes being driven into rock. The Prince's Corps of Engineers is building a road. That ridge runs all the way from the teeth of the world, down through Darkmoor, and halfway to Kesh. It's almost impossible to cross anywhere there isn't a road, and more than one traveller's been found dead up there. That's why we call it Nightmare Ridge. You get lost anywhere up there in cold weather, you're a dead man. Kalis nodded. That's the place. You weren't supposed to be there, Eric. Captain Subai was not pleased, nor was Prince Patrick. But yes, that's why no one is permitted to go there, in case the enemy does have agents snooping around outside Grondor. Eric blurted. You're going to abandon the city? Kalis sighed. I wish it were that simple. He was silent as he watched the sunset. Brilliant orange and pink, faced by black clouds far away, over the sea, gave an unreal quality to the approaching evening, as if nothing that beautiful should exist in the same world as the coming evil. Kalis looked at Eric. We have several plans in place. You need worry only about the disposition of soldiers under your command. You'll be told where to take them and what your options are. Once you are in the mountains with your soldiers, you'll have to make the decisions, Eric. You'll have to judge what is best for both your men and the overall campaign. A great deal will ride on your judgment. But until the Prince and Knight Marshal are ready to brief you on the overall operation, I will not give you details you might blurt out to the wrong person. The infiltrators. That, or if you're abducted and some agent of the Pantathians doses you with some potion to make you speak, or if they have mind readers like the Lady Gamina in their employ. We have no idea what might happen. That's why whatever you hear you share with no man, and you're only to be told what you need to know. Eric nodded. I'm worried. About the girl? Eric was surprised. You know about that? Kalis motioned they should start walking after the departing soldiers and said, What sort of captain would I be if I didn't know about my sergeant major's life outside the barracks? Eric had no answer for that. He said, Of course I'm worried about Kitty. I'm worried about Rue and his family, too. I'm worried about everybody. Now you're starting to sound like Bobby, though he would never have voiced it that way. Kalis smiled. He'd have said, We've got too damn much work to do, and half the time needed, and a bunch of incompetent fools doing it. Eric laughed. That sounds like him. I miss him, Eric. I know you do as well. But Bobby was one of the first I picked. The first of my desperate men. Eric said, I thought you fetched him from the border barons to work for you. Kalis laughed. Bobby would have put it that way. He failed to mention he was going to be hanged for having killed another soldier in a brawl. I had to beat him a half dozen times to get him to control his temper. Beat him? Asked Eric. Negotiating his way over a large rock as they followed the gully downward. I told him each time he lost his temper, I'd strip to the waist and we'd have at it. If he was standing and I was not, he was a free man. It took that fool 6 beatings before he finally realized I was a great deal stronger than I look. Eric knew that was the truth. The captain's father was a man called Tomas, some sort of lord or another up in the north. By all rumours, his mother was the elf queen. But whatever the truth of his parentage, Kalis's strength was unmatched by that of any man Eric had run across. The former smith from Ravensburg had been the strongest man in his village, and of all those soldiers who had served with him on his first voyage to Novindus, only the huge man named Biggo was his equal. But Kalis had done things that Eric could only judge impossible. He had once seen the captain easily pick up a wagon so Eric could replace the wheel. When Eric knew from experience, he would have needed the help of at least two other men to duplicate the feat. Considering Bobby de Loungeville's nature, Eric said, "I'm surprised you didn't have to kill him." Kalis laughed. "I came close twice. Bobby wasn't the man to take defeat easily. When I came back from that first trip to Navindus, and we came limping into Krondor Harbour like whipped hounds, Prince Aruta called me the Eagle, because of the banner on our ship." Eric nodded. He knew as well as any man that in that distant land, Kalis played the part of a mercenary captain, and his company was called the Crimson Eagles. Bobby elected to call himself the Dog of Krondor. Prince Aruta seemed less than pleased, but said nothing. Kalis stopped and restrained Eric. "Don't say anything to anyone about what you suspect, Eric. I don't want to lose another Sergeant Major. Bobby may have fancied himself a dog, but he was a loyal and tough one. You're just as loyal and just as tough, though you don't know it yet." Eric nodded at the compliment. "Thank you, sir. I'm not through. I don't want to lose another Sergeant Major because Duke James hanged him to keep him silent." He looked Eric in the eyes. "Do I make myself clear?"
"Very."
"Come along, then. We've got to march this lot back to Krondor and hand them over to William to turn into garrison rats. If they somehow find themselves in the mountains, they may survive a little longer than the average soldier, so we've done them a favour. But none of these men will be of service to us."
Eric said, "That's the truth."
"Go find me some more men, Eric. Desperate men if you must, but get me some men we can train."
"Where should I seek them?" asked Eric.
Kalis said, "Go see the king before he leaves Krondor. If you ask him nicely, he may give you a warrant so you can steal the Border Baron's best men from them. The barons will not be happy when you do this, but if we lose this war, invasion from the Northlands is the last thing we'll need worry about."
Eric, remembering the map of the kingdom in William's office, said, "That means a journey to Northwarden, Iron Pass, and High Castle."
"Start with Iron Pass," instructed Kalis. "You'll have to move fast, and while you're bringing the men south, march them through the Dimwood and avoid Sethanon. Get them here as soon as you can." Then, with what Eric had come to think of as Kalis's evil grin, he said, "You have 2 months."
Eric suppressed a groan. "I need 3.
"Kill some mounts getting there if you must, but you have 2. I need another 600 good men, 200 from each of those garrisons here in Krondor, in 2 months."
"That'll leave 'em with less than half their standard garrison. All of the barons will object."
"Of course they'll object," said Kalis with a laugh. "That's why you need the king's warrant."
Eric hesitated, then set off in a jog, leaving a startled Kalis behind.
"Where are you running to?"
"Krondor," said Eric. "I need all the time I can squeeze, and there's someone I must say goodbye to."
Kalis's laughter faded into the background as Eric continued to run. He was still running when he passed a startled Alfred and the men marching back to camp. Eric had spent a difficult day with the king and then with Kitty. While the king wasn't too adverse to stripping his northern garrisons of soldiers, needed there to defend his realm from the marauding goblins and dark elves, he was less than enthused with Kalis entrusting the task of selecting those men to a sergeant. He reminded Eric that he carried court rank now, and he shouldn't let any of the barons question his right to carry out those orders. But silently, Eric wondered how he would force a nobleman, with nearly 400 armed men trained to obey, to do what Eric wanted, should the king's warrant prove insufficient. He told Jadow that Kalis would be returning later with the men who were to be reassigned to the prince's garrison, and then left to find Kitty.
She took the news of his 2-month absence with a calm exterior, but Eric had come to know her well enough to see she was upset. He wished he could spend one more day with her, but knew that Kalis's time limit was nearly impossible. They slipped out of the inn and spent an emotional hour together, and at the end Eric had come as close as he dared to breaking his word to Kalis about not repeating what he suspected. He just warned Kitty that should he not be around when that something big she suspected finally happened, she should slip out of Krondor and head to Ravensburg. He knew that when word of the invaders finally reached the city, there would be a little time to flee before the prince ordered the city sealed. Kitty was smart enough to know what he meant, and she would head to the Inn of the Pintail in Ravensburg to be with Freida, his mother, and Nathan, his stepfather. He promised he would find her there. Eric left 2 hours before sundown. He knew he would have to put up at an inn along the way, but every hour he could steal would be worth the extra expense. Besides, he was spending the king's gold, not his own. Sundown found him still an hour from the nearest inn. The little moon was up, so it wasn't completely dark, and the king's highway was a clearly marked way. But Eric walked his horse rather than risk an injury by having the animal stumble. His horse was a tough little roan gelding he had selected himself. It wasn't as strong or as large as most of the horses in the prince's stable, but it was likely to possess more endurance than most of the animals Eric might choose. He would switch mounts often on this journey, and he would be in the saddle from before dawn to after dusk for nearly 2 weeks to reach Iron Pass. And even then he would have to push the horses to the end of their endurance. But it could be done. Silently, Eric cursed his captain and rode into the night. Nakor pointed.
There, again.
Chopai nodded.
As it was last time, master.
Nakor resisted the impulse to tell the young man to cease calling him master. It was as pointless as telling a dog not to scratch fleas.
Keshian patrols along the south coast of the Sea of Dreams, observed Nakor. Last time Kalis informed the garrison commander, yet here again we see Keshian lancers riding with their colours unfurled.
After a moment he laughed.
What is funny, master?
Nakor struck the young man lightly with the back of his hand on Chopai's shoulder.
It's obvious, boy. Lord Aruta has made a deal.
A deal? Asked Chopai, as the boat's captain turned his craft toward the shore.
You'll see, said the little man.
He and his disciple had taken ship from Krondor and sailed through the inlet into the waterway between the Bitter Sea and the Sea of Dreams. They were now on a riverboat heading to Port Shamata, where they would buy horses and ride to Stardock. Nakor carried documents for Lord Aruta and orders from Prince Patrick and Duke James. Nakor had a nagging suspicion he knew what was in those documents, for several of them bore the king's own crest, not that of the prince. The balance of the journey passed uneventfully, and eventually Nakor and Chopai found themselves on the raft that served to carry passengers and goods across the Great Star Lake to the island of Stardock, and the community of magicians that resided there. Aruta, Lord Venkar, Earl of the King's Court, and son of Duke James, met them at the landing.
Nakor! Chopai! It's good to see you two again!
He laughed.
Our last meeting was far too brief.
Nakor also laughed. He had spent less than 2 minutes in the newly arrived Earl's company before departing with Chopai and Pug to travel to Elvendar. As they jumped the narrowing gap between barge and dock, Nakor said,
I have messages from your father.
Aruta said, Come with me then.
How did you know we were on the barge?
Asked Nakor. As they walked to the huge building that was Stardock, the man the king had sent to administer the Island of Magicians said,
Something mundane. Our lookout saw you from up there.
He pointed to one of the windows in a high tower.
He sent word to me.
Must be one of my students, said Nakor, nodding.
Inside the building, they traversed a long hall and moved toward what Nakor knew would be Aruta's office. It was the same one he had taken when he had been placed in charge of the island by Kalis.
Are Charms, Kaliad, and the others giving you any trouble? Asked Nakor.
At mention of the Keshian-born traditionalist, who resisted the idea of this island's being subject to the king's law, Aruta shook his head and said, None worth mentioning. They grouse a bit now and again, but as long as they're free to teach and do their research, they don't complain too much about my administration.
Nakor said, I suspect they're plotting.
No doubt, agreed Aruta as they reached his office. But I think it won't amount to much without outside help. They're too spineless to attempt to secede from the kingdom without a strong ally. Once inside the office, Aruta closed the door. And we're prepared for that, said the Earl, as he took the packet of documents his father had sent. Excuse me a moment, he said, and broke the seal on the first of those, a personal message from the Duke. As he read, Nakor studied the Earl. He was as tall as his father, but looked more like his mother, with fine features and an almost delicate mouth. His eyes, though, thought Nakor, were his father's. They were dangerous. His hair was like his father's, too, as it had been when James was a young man, tight, dark brown curls. After a moment, Aruta said, Do you know what's in here?
No, said Nakor, but I can guess. Erland has just returned from Kesh. Did he pass this way?
Aruta laughed. Well, not much gets by you, does it?
When you've lived by your wits as long as I have, said Nakor, you learn to pay attention to everything.
Yes, Erland stopped for one night on his way home.
Then you've made a deal with Kesh.
Aruta said, Let's say we've come to an understanding. If Chopai was lost in the conversation, he gave no sign, seemingly content to let his master and the Earl speak uninterrupted. Nakor laughed.
Your father is the most evil, dangerous man I've ever met. It's a good thing he's on our side.
Aruta looked rueful. You'll get no argument from me in that regard. My life has never been my own. Nakor took the message as Aruta handed it across the desk.
You don't seem particularly bothered by this, observed the gambler.
Aruta shrugged. I had the usual rebellious nature most young men possess. But, truth to tell, most of what my father had me do was interesting, and challenging even. My sons, as you may have gathered, were a completely different case. My wife is quite a bit more forgiving of adventuresome natures than my mother was. He stood up as Nakor read the Duke's message. I've often thought what father's life must have been like, to be literally raised a thief in the sewers of Krondor. He glanced out a small window that overlooked the shoreline. I've heard enough Jimmy the Hand stories to last a lifetime.
I didn't think your father was much on bragging, observed Chopai, as Nakor continued to read.
Not from father, but from others, said Aruta. Father has changed the history of the kingdom. He fell into a thoughtful silence. It can be a difficult thing to be the son of a great man.
Nakor said, People expect much of a great man's son.
He put the document on the desk.
You want me to stay?
For a while, said Aruta. I need someone trustworthy here when all this breaks out. I need some reassurance that Charms and the others don't react badly.
Oh, they'll react badly enough when they see what your father and Prince Erland have cooked up, said Nakor with a small laugh. But I'll make sure no one gets hurt.
Good. I'll leave next week after I've seen to a few more necessary details.
You need to return to Krondor? Asked Nakor.
Aruta nodded. I know my father.
Nakor sighed. I understand.
Aruta said. You have the same rooms as before, so rest and I'll see you at dinner. Sensing they were being dismissed, Chopai rose and opened the door for Nakor. After they had left the Earl's office, Chopai said,
Master, what did you mean by asking Lord Aruta if he needed to return?
His father ordered him to Rillinon, on a thin pretext of carrying messages to the king, said Nakor, as they turned a corner leading to the suite of rooms set aside for them.
Climbing a flight of stairs, Nakor continued,
Aruta knows his father is unlikely to leave Krondor when the fighting starts. He wants to see that his sons don't stay with their grandfather.
I know war is risky, said the former soldier, but why should the Duke's grandsons be at any greater risk than anyone else?
Because it is unlikely that anyone who is in Krondor when the Queen's fleet arrives will survive,
Nakor answered flatly. Chopai remained silent as they reached their quarters. Eric signaled and the riders stopped. One of his scouts was riding back toward him. He had spent the better part of 2 months raiding the border barons for their best men, and now almost 600 men rode in 3 columns, spread out over 20 miles and a half behind him. It had been an exhausting ride, and Eric was cursing Kalis with almost every mile of it, but he had his men. Each border baron he had visited had read the king's warrant with a mix of disbelief and outrage. Each baron was unique in that he was a vassal of the crown, answerable to no earl or duke. To have a mere sergeant-major of the prince's garrison walk in with orders to let him hand-pick men to be taken away, while promises of replacements were vague at best, was more than they could withstand. Baron Northwarden had even considered attempting to hold Eric for confirmation of the order, but by then Eric had an armed company of nearly 200 men with him, and the baron thought better of it. At Highcastle, the baron merely looked as if another weight had been added to his already abundant burden, and complied with a minimum of complaint. Eric suspected the company of 400 men, wearing the livery of Northwarden and Ironpass, also convinced him. They had ridden through the vast grasslands of the High Wold, home to nomadic tribesmen, herding their sheep and trading with the barons and those small villages that survived this close to the Northlands. Several times they had found camps recently abandoned, as if the approach of so many armed men had caused bandits to flee into the hills. After the third such camp had been encountered, Eric had ordered 2 of the men from Ironpass to ride advance scout. Eric found it slightly discomforting to think of any problems this far within the border of the kingdom, but of all the lands between the far coast and the kingdom sea, those lands between the teeth of the world, the great northern mountain range, and the boundary of the Dimwood were among the most hostile. Raiding parties of goblins and dark elves were known to have travelled as far south as Sethanon in the years before the Rift War, and no matter the frequency of kingdom patrols through these areas, they still remained wild and inhospitable. They were presently riding through light woodlands, leading toward the far denser Dimwood, and now Eric had lost count of the ideal places for ambush he had ridden past. The first scout reined in and said,
"An armed camp, Sergeant Major. At least 100 men.
"What?" said Eric. "Did anyone see you?"
"No, they post no scouts, and seemed unconcerned about it. I believe they think themselves alone here."
"Could you mark them?"
"No banner flew, and they wore neither uniform nor tabard. They look like brigands."
Eric dismissed the scout, and turned to the man he had named acting corporal, a sergeant from Ironpass named Garrett.
"I want a skirmish line behind us by 50 yards, half the men. At the first sound of trouble, I want them to sweep in from either side. The rest should ready themselves to hit hard up the middle if needed, by column of 2. Get 4 of your best and ride with me."
At least a decade, Eric Senior, The man showed no hesitation in taking orders from the younger man. Eric liked his attitude and his discipline, and planned on making him a sergeant as soon as possible, because in Garrett he sensed someone who'd keep his men alive. That was the one thing about Kalis's plan Eric grudgingly approved of. The men he had been sent to fetch had been hardened by years of fighting goblins, dark elves, and bandits. Most of them were mountain fighters by experience, and it would take little to meld them into the force Eric already had under his command. Like the trained soldiers they were, the first 20 men spread out behind Eric. He told Garrett, "Get ready for trouble." Orders were passed, and Eric, Garrett, and the four men he had chosen rode forward. They slowly picked their way through the trees and came within sight of campfires. Close to 80 men lay about or stood talking in a clearing in the woods. A few dozen tents of various size were erected in haphazard fashion, and some men tended cooking fires and saw two provisions near the middle of the clearing. Eric saw baggage wagons and horses staked out near the far edge. To Garrett he said, "This is no band of outlaws." The older soldier nodded silent agreement.
"We'd better hit them hard."
There was no question in his mind. They were heading for a fight. Eric wondered. While it was not quite midday, many of the men were sleeping. Eric held up his hand and spoke softly.
"They're waiting for someone." "How do you know, Sergeant Major?" asked Garrett. "They're bored, and they've been here for at least a week."
He pointed to a slit trench over to their right.
Garrett said, "I can smell it. You're right. They've been here for a while. And unless I'm mistaken, there's nothing here worth waiting for. So they're waiting for someone else to show up." "Who?" "That's what I intend to find out."
He motioned the men forward, and they walked their horses to within sight of the camp. A bored soldier sat polishing his sword, and he glanced up as Eric and the others hove into view. His eyes widened, and he shouted. As soon as Eric heard the man's voice, the hair on the back of his neck stood up, and he shouted to the rear,
"Attack!"
Swords were in hands without thought, and the sound of the riders coming hard filled the afternoon air. In the camp, men ran to bedrolls and pulled on armor as they could, or grabbed shields and swords, bows and arrows, and the fight began. As Eric had planned, the column of twos rode into the center of the camp behind him, just as a sweeping skirmish line encircled the camp. Men screamed as arrows filled the air, and steel rang upon steel as the riders swept into the clearing. Many of the men who rode with Eric were mounted bowmen and quickly picked off targets as men struggled to don armor. Eric rode down two men as he headed for the center of the camp. Whoever led these men was certain to be there, and he intended to find the leader before some overly eager kingdom archer skewered him with a bow shaft. Eric saw the leader. The man was an oasis of calm, as those around him ran in every direction. He shouted orders and attempted to bend his men by force of will into an effective fighting force. Eric put heels to his horse and charged him. The leader sensed, more than saw, Eric approach, so intent was he on directing his men. He turned to see the horse and rider almost on top of him and dove to one side, avoiding Eric's charge. Eric turned his mount and found the man, now armed with sword and shield, quickly retrieved from the ground. Eric knew he faced a tough opponent, for the man had dived in the direction of his weapons. He would not rattle. Eric knew better than to charge him again, for to do so was to risk having the man duck under his attack and hamstring his horse. He was probably calm and confident enough to attempt that dangerous move. His men were taking a terrible toll on those in camp, and Eric circled his opposite number, waiting. The man eyed him warily, ready for the charge that didn't come, and Eric shouted,
"Keep as many of them alive as possible!"
When it became clear that the men in the camp were hopelessly outclassed by those on horseback, soldiers began throwing down their weapons and crying for quarter. Quickly, the matter resolved itself in Eric's favour, and when at last there was no doubt, the leader threw down his weapon. Eric knew that in Nevindus it was the accepted sign of surrender by mercenaries. Eric glanced around and saw a banner lying on the ground. The emblem was familiar to him. Eric rode his horse toward the man. Garrett and the other soldiers looked perplexed as the prince's sergeant major spoke in a strange tongue. "To the man," Eric said.
"Duga and his war dogs, if I'm not mistaken."
The man nodded.
"Who are you?"
"I rode with Kaelis's Crimson Eagles."
Captain Duga, mercenary leader of 100 Swords, sighed.
You were to be killed on sight, and that was on the other side of the world."
"You've come a long way," observed Eric.
"That's the truth."
He glanced around and saw his men being disarmed by Eric's.
"What now?"
"That depends. If you cooperate, you'll get a chance to stay alive. If you don't..."
"I won't break oath,"
Duga said. Eric studied the man. He had been almost a classic mercenary captain in Nevindus. Clever, if not intelligent, but smart enough to keep his men alive, a requirement of any captain. He'd be tough enough to keep a surly band of cutthroats in line, and he'd be honest enough to keep contracts, else no one would hire him.
"No oath need be broken. You're our prisoner, but we can hardly give you parole to return home."
Bitterly, the man said,
"I don't even know where home is."
Eric pointed to the southwest.
"That way, on the other side of the world, as you said."
"Care to loan us a boat?"
Duga asked with bitter irony.
"Perhaps. If you share some information with us, you might find yourself with some opportunity to return home."
Eric didn't comment on how slim the chance of that occurring might be.
"Talk," said Duga.
"Start with, how did you get here?"
"Through one of those magic gates the snake men make."
He shrugged.
"They offered a bonus for any captain who led his men through."
He glanced around.
"Though where I'll spend it, the gods only know."
Eric said, "How long have you been here?"
3 weeks.
"Who are you waiting for?"
"I don't know,"
said the captain of mercenaries from Nevindus.
"All I know is the orders from General Fadawar were simple. Go through this rift thing and find a place to camp nearby. Then wait."
"For what?"
"I don't know. I just know we were told to wait."
Eric felt a stab of uncertainty. Until the next element of his column arrived, he had almost as many prisoners as he had men to guard them, and at any moment new enemies might appear. Thinking quickly, he said,
"Limited parole. You'll not be armed, but we won't let you ride away. We'll negotiate better terms when we get to our camp."
The mercenary considered it for a moment, then said,
"Done."
With obvious relief, he shouted to his men,
"No more fighting! Now, let's eat!"
Eric once more was amazed at the attitude of mercenaries from Nevindus, who treated conflict and fighting as jobs, who faced men across the line one day, who might have been allies the year before, and might be again some day, and who carried little or no ill will as a result. Eric motioned to Garrett and said,
"After things settle down, make camp and let the men eat."
The sergeant from Ironpass saluted and started giving orders. Eric stretched in the saddle and felt as if every bone were jangled out of its joint. His backside was sore, and he couldn't remember ever having been this tired.
With a silent groan, he dismounted, and, smelling the food on the fires, realized he was hungry. Before beginning the questioning of the prisoners, he paused once more to curse his captain. He started to tend his horse, and again paused a moment to curse Kalis.